Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. ChooseWood.com.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is St. Louis on the Air.
I don't like it at all. This is one of those cases that keeps me up at night.
Churches aren't exempt from investigations where there's probable cause.
Yeah, I love Dave Rowland's concept, if we lived in unicorn land. Unfortunately, churches have not policed themselves.
And I have to believe that the governor and those around him understand the definition of criminal hacking.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Sarah Fenske. Happy Monday. In recent weeks, a federal judge declared that a key portion of Missouri's medical marijuana program is unconstitutional. Could that be a fatal blow to its licensing system? And what about the Rams? There's been a lot of news lately about the lawsuit St. Louis City and County filed against Stan Kroenke and the NFL. One of the key attorneys pushing the lawsuit has now been removed from the case. What does that mean for local hopes for a big payday? Those are important questions, and today our legal roundtable is here to analyze them. And this month, that includes Nicole Gorofsky. She's a former federal prosecutor. She's now in private practice at Gorofsky Law. Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined today by Dave Rowland. He's the litigation director at the Freedom Center of Missouri. Dave, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Sarah.
And last but not least, this month, we're joined by Yinka Folletti. Yinka is a former litigator at Bryan Cave Leighton Paisner, a former state prosecutor at the Circuit Attorney's Office, and the 2020 Democratic nominee for Missouri Secretary of State. We're so excited that he's here with us today. Yinka, welcome.
Thank you, Sarah. Great to be here.
So we're going to get to medical marijuana, and we're going to get to the litigation over the Rams' departure. You know that's one of my favorite topics. But first, we need to address a big story in the news lately. One that now involves the threat of litigation. 2 weeks ago, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch published a scoop. It had found a serious vulnerability in the State Department of Education website. Social security numbers of school employees throughout Missouri were embedded into the HTML source code. Now, the paper, in its investigation, quoted an expert. Shaji Khan is a cybersecurity professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He confirmed the paper's finding and called the vulnerability a, quote, serious flaw. We have known about this type of flaw for at least 10 to 12 years, if not more, Khan told the paper in an email. The fact that this type of vulnerability is still present in the state web application is mind-boggling. Now, of course, the paper quoted that in its story. Governor Parson was not happy with the story. He suggested the people involved were hackers and referred the matter for criminal prosecution. Now, Professor Khan has now hired a lawyer, and that lawyer, that's Elad Gross, sent a letter to Parson demanding an apology and asking for a litigation hold on matters related to the case. So, Nicole Gorofsky, we now have this threatening letter, a demand for an apology. Could this expert, this UMSL professor, possibly have a case against Governor Parson?
Yeah, I think he could possibly have a case. So, to sue someone for defamation, what you have to have is some kind of public statement, and it has to be false, and it has to cause damage to a person's reputation. So what Mr. Khan is saying is that Governor Parson basically made a public statement calling him a hacker. That is not true. He's not a hacker. I mean, he's saying basically this information was out there in the public. It was easy to get, and that it damaged his reputation. So what Mr. Khan is saying is that he's gotten several complaints from people that he's worked with and all kinds of things that have happened that have damaged his reputation. So those are the elements of a defamation case, and I think potentially he could have one.
Yinka, does it make any difference? I don't believe I saw anywhere that the governor called him out by name. He was talking a lot of smack about this story, and you could tell he was not happy with the Post-Dispatch. But this guy, you would have to actually read the Post-Dispatch story to know that he was even involved. Does that make it harder for him to advance a claim here?
Yeah, well, so another one of the elements is that it identifies the plaintiff. And so that's, to your point, is does it expressly identify the plaintiff? And, I think it's while he may have a claim, I think it may be challenging to win on it. We know that typically executive office holders enjoy some form of qualified immunity.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, even if he did have a claim, could he win in court? And I think that might be challenging. And I think that's why you see, in part, Elad Gross and what they're asking for is an apology, and they're kind of leading with that. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's more about that than anything else.
So this qualified immunity, the governor can get away with saying things that might be defamatory in a way that a private citizen can't. Dave, do you think that might be enough that the governor could be okay on this one, even though all experts seem to agree he does not know what he's talking about HTML source code?
Well, so I think there are a couple of issues here. The first is, just as a general matter, I tell people defamation claims are among the most difficult to succeed on. And so even if they were able to show that what the governor said was defamatory, or at least that it was derogatory, I think that there's also the question of whether the professor would be considered a public figure. He did insert himself into this matter of public interest. He allowed himself to be quoted by the Post-Dispatch, and therefore he might be considered a public figure, which makes it that much more difficult to succeed in a defamation claim. When it comes to qualified immunity usually gets invoked when someone is arguing that a government official has violated the citizen's constitutional rights. And I don't think that's what happened here. Now, if the government was to pursue prosecution against this professor, then arguably he could respond and say, look, this is retaliation for me exercising my First Amendment rights. And that's where you might see kind of a responsive First Amendment lawsuit. And qualified immunity might get involved at that point. I'm not sure that it would be involved in a straight-up defamation claim made by this professor.
So, Nicole, Dave has raised the specter of criminal prosecution, and I think it's fair for Dave to raise that because that's where the governor was taking this. Now, again, experts are saying this was not a case of hacking, but we all know sometimes these investigations can go awry. Do you think this Post-Dispatch reporter or this expert, that they may have cause to fear that somebody could build a criminal case against them?
Well, sure. I mean, the governor has a lot of power, but I think it would be a ridiculous criminal investigation. I'm not going to lie about that. But again, the governor has a lot of power. We've seen crazier things happen. So, yeah, I would be a little nervous. And but again, I don't think there's a crime that happened here.
So you mentioned Yinka Elad Gross, who's the attorney for Professor Khan. And Elad is, he's an activist, you know, he's a great gadfly. He loves to fight on behalf of the little guy here. Is there a chance for him to maybe have some fun with discovery or have some fun with sort of getting to the bottom of who's advising Governor Parson on this, even if there's not a good room for damages here?
Yeah, there's always opportunity to have fun in discovery. And I think you're right. You know, we all know Elad in this past election cycle ran for attorney general. And he has been very vocal about what he sees as abuses of power with our state government, including the governor's office. So there's always potential for that. You know, I don't know if this is going to go that far. We've already seen the governor say that the investigation and the initial remedy is going to cost up to $50 million, and most of which would go to monitoring of credit for these teachers. You know, so we'll see. It's possible. I think the governor is a bit in the driver's seat on this one.
Hmm.
To see how far he wants to take it.
So you've thrown your hat into the political ring. If you were the governor, would you keep driving this or would you apologize and try to like get out from under this thing?
Well, if I were the governor, I would do a lot of things differently. But in this particular case, I think he's somewhat cornered himself because he's gone after two entities here. He's gone after the Post-Dispatch reporter, and he's gone after the professor. And I have to believe that the governor and those around him understand the definition of criminal hacking. And they have to understand that this does not, on its face, meet that definition. So if I were him, I might find a way to gracefully back out of this and not pursue it any further.
Dave, I see you nodding on that. You'd be looking for that way to gracefully back out.
Yeah, I think that the graceful exit would be the wise strategy here. You know, I do think that the governor has control of this situation insofar as he has the opportunity to say, I have made the decision that we're not going to pursue this any further. He doesn't necessarily have to apologize to do that. But I would say if he does not apologize, then there is that possibility that Elad and the professor could force the issue. And so maybe an apology is a smart move in that it seems like it would draw a definitive close to this issue, whereas otherwise it could draw out, you know, into the next election cycle.
Yeah, and let's not forget that it's not, although it is an apology to Mr. Khan, it's not just an apology to Mr. Khan. There are all these teachers out there whose personal information is out there for people to see, and, you know, they deserve an apology.
I want to talk about another matter involving state politics. Now, Auditor Nicole Galloway did some audits of now Senator Josh Hawley's time as Attorney General. Those audits were critical of his use of office resources. In one case, Galloway found a state employee drove Hawley and his wife to a Chiefs game in Kansas City. Well, Hawley has found a way to get back at her. He called on the State Board of Accountancy to investigate the auditor for releasing information about his office. The board opened a probe, and apparently they recently issued a settlement agreement with Galloway offering public censure as a way to close this matter out. They apparently objected to something in the public audit of the AG's office, and they stated in this that the AG's office was a client of the state auditor. So Galloway has now filed a lawsuit. She's not suing Hawley. She's suing this board of accountancy. She says the state agencies she audits are not clients and that it's her job to put this kind of information in front of the public, and this could be a big problem. Nicole, thoughts on this case?
Yeah, this is really strange. So I guess essentially what Hawley is trying, was trying to say was that that somehow if her client is the state, then she has to ask the state for permission before releasing this information, which is completely antithetical to what the state auditor is supposed to do, which is be the transparent voice for the people of the state of Missouri when something is being inappropriately used, funds are being inappropriately used in the state. So that's why Nicole Galloway is coming back and saying, if Hawley is actually allowed to do this, then you've basically taken the rug out from under my job, from the state auditor's job, that by attempting to control the information that I can make available to the public, then you're basically saying I can't act as the state auditor. And this is, I think, a terrifying proposition. I think she's absolutely right, that they could actually take the wind out of the auditor's sails, which essentially kind of guts the purpose of the auditor's position.
Yeah, I mean, she's making this point here. She's saying that this would really reduce government transparency. She says the board's interpretation is contrary to the policy of the state of Missouri, that government records are open and that any exceptions shall be strictly construed to promote open government. Dave, I know you're a big open records guy. Do you think Nicole Galloway has a good point here? This is a problem.
I think she's absolutely correct. I think the problem is it's bigger than this limited situation as well, though, because what it represents to me is the continued weaponization of the legal system by political opponents. Now, that in and of itself is not new, but this is kind of a new horizon for that battle, and it's really concerning because you know who's funding all of this litigation? It's the taxpayers. And although I think that Galloway's position is going to be vindicated eventually by the courts, there is still the possibility that it would not be vindicated, and that would be a severe blow to the whole idea of government transparency and also to the responsibilities of the auditor's office. The auditor exists to hold government officials to account. And if you are kneecapping the office's ability to do that, it raises the question, why do we have an auditor's office at all?
So, Yinka, our two other panelists feel pretty firmly that the law is on Nicole Galloway's side on this, and yet at the same time, this is a battle that is, it has politics at its core. You have Josh Hawley versus Nicole Galloway. Do you think a court might be hesitant to weigh in and get involved in something that is this political?
Yeah, this reeks of politics. I mean, it is from A to Z seemingly political, because when you take a look at what this board, when you read the statute that governs what this board is about, the Board of Accountancy is a unit of the Division of Professional Registration by the Department of Commerce and Insurance. And their whole job is to deal with CPAs in the state and accountants in the state in terms of examining, certifying, licensing, not the auditor's office. And so when you read Nicole's, you know, her what she's seeking, declaratory judgment, injunctive relief, when you read that, and she, their lawyers laid out pretty well that, you know, this is not a CPA dealing with a client.
Right.
This is the state auditor dealing with an elected official. By the way, the case that the audit was referred to Nicole. Nicole was, you had the Secretary of State, Ashcroft, saying to Nicole, hey, we want you to take a look at this. And so there's a whole lot of politics in this. I think a judge all the more will want to rule well in this case, because as David talked about, you've got to be careful to not set a precedent where you're allowing politics to dictate the constitutional powers and authorities of the state auditor or any other state office holder for that matter.
So a judge could see they have a really important responsibility right here. They're not going to shy away from that.
I think so.
We need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the latest on the legal battle over the Rams' departure, always such a juicy topic. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. ChooseWood.com.
And now back to our legal roundtable. I want to get to the Rams litigation in just a moment, but Nicole also had one other point that feels really relevant to this discussion that we're talking about involving the Board of Accountancy and Auditor Nicole Galloway's battle with them. Nicole, what were you sharing about this?
Yeah, so one thing that makes this an even more political battle is that the Board of Accountancy is appointed by the governor. So, you know, if you have a governor and you have Hawley who's pushing the board to look into these issues, then, you know, the fact that they're all the same party and Nicole Galloway is the opposite party is kind of reeks of an issue.
Makes it even more important maybe to have a judge get involved.
Correct.
Well, if you have questions about anything we're talking about today, specifically related to the legal part of what we're talking about today, I know a lot of people have thoughts on the politics here, but we're trying to stick to the legal matters at hand. Our phone lines are open at 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at STL on air, and you may well have some legal questions about the Rams. I know I always do, and I'm very happy that I have this panel here to answer them. There is so much happening, so fast and furious in these cases. I feel like both sides have really good, really expensive attorneys, and they are leaving no motion unfiled as they try to get the upper hand. Now, the Rams and the NFL, they have lost a number of motions lately. Things have not looked that good for them. But in this past month, they won one. They got Bob Blitz, and he's the longtime lawyer for the local sporting authority. They got him tossed off the case. So I guess my question is, was this a clever way to get a good lawyer taken off this case, or was there a real conflict here? And this conflict had to do with meetings he attended as a lawyer for these parties that are now suing. Yinka, what's your take on this?
This is like red meat for lawyers. I mean, you've just got to love this. You talk about strategy. And this litigation began, I believe, in, I want to say, 2017. So this is not a brand new case, and 4 months before trial, one side moves to strike a leading attorney from the case. Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's interesting is Judge McGraw's order, and he had some discretion. You know, judges have discretion in these matters, and he could have decided that disqualification of Blitz would work substantial hardship on the clients, on the plaintiffs here. But he decides to allow it. But he doesn't strike the deposition testimony, which the NFL owners wanted. So you can kind of see this as a split the baby kind of move where he and you know, this is a national case. I mean, you don't get bigger than this. You don't get bigger than one of the most profitable clubs in an entire National Football League. Not only them, but these other owners, Dallas Cowboys owners, Giants owners, etc. I mean, this is a big deal. You're talking about, what, $1 billion on the line, maybe more? I mean, it's huge. And so the judge has got to be very, very careful to not appear to be partial in any way and not give any grounds, any additional grounds, many grounds already potentially for appeal, but not give any additional. So I think he's splitting the baby here, allowing them to disqualify the attorney, but also allowing the deposition testimony to come in.
Nicole, do you think he made the right call here?
First of all, I think Yinka set that up beautifully. I think that's absolutely the right analysis. I think the judge was probably in a really hard place. I think, you know, attorneys are supposed to avoid even the appearance of a conflict. I think it's a really tough call. And I think, you know, obviously we weren't there for the arguments, but I think the other side set up some argument that Blitz could actually be a witness in the case. And so if that's the case, then he's, you know, the judge had to make that call. And I know it's a tough call, but I think it had to be made.
So as someone who has relatively little money, I don't have the millions that the NFL has. This sort of strikes fear in my heart because I want my lawyer to be able to be a part of these important meetings, right? And then I don't want to have to pay a completely other lawyer to get up to speed because that lawyer has then been booted off the case just for going to these meetings.
Yeah, so there's another part of this that stinks to high heaven, which is the fact that the attorneys for the NFL let it go on this long, let this attorney work this case for so long, and then move to get him off the case, right? That seems a little bit like sandbagging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a problem. So, like I said, I think the judge had a really tough call on his hands, but I think, you know, I think he had to do it.
So Bill McClellan, the columnist for the Post-Dispatch, I love that guy. He just has such an interesting brain. He was trying to make the case when I saw him last week that this is actually good for St. Louis. He said you can't have two quarterbacks. And by moving Bob Blitz out, he says this lets the superior lawyer, he believes, Jim Bennett of Dowd Bennett, a very good law firm, this lets him take the lead and makes clear who's in charge. And otherwise, he says, this would have been this disorganized thing where you have two very strong lawyers pulling in different directions. Dave, you've done some trials. Do you think Bill has a point here?
I like Bill a lot, too. I'm not sure that he's correct in this instance, but what I will say is I don't think St. Louis is hurt as a result of this disqualification. Because, you know, it was not only Blitz's game here. I mean, he had the assistance of other exceptionally qualified attorneys. And so the fact that Blitz is out of the picture doesn't mean that St. Louis doesn't have excellent legal representation. It just means he's not part of that element anymore. And I don't think that that's going to hurt them at all. One thing that I want to say about this is people are focused very much on everything that's happening at the trial level. But I've seen some commentators point out that the NFL has a history of losing cases at the trial level that they then go on to win at the appellate level. Now, we don't know that this is going to happen in this particular circumstance. But the way that the cards seem to be aligning themselves is it looks like St. Louis has a very good case at the trial level. The question is whether anything that they win there would then hold up on appeal. Maybe the calculus is a little bit better for St. Louis, given that we're in state court rather than federal court. But the NFL has very good attorneys on their side, too. So just keep in mind, this is a story that's not going away even when the trial concludes.
Yinka?
Yeah, and it's not clear from the judge's order that Blitz cannot continue to work on the case in the background. The judge's order prohibits Blitz from acting as an advocate at trial.
Oh.
So it doesn't preclude him from, it doesn't expressly preclude him from continuing to work on the case in the background. So that's an interesting dynamic. You may still have Bob Blitz's brains and mind and contributions. He just can't be an advocate at trial.
Interesting.
And that's another reason why it was, a good decision by the judge, because if you really think the case is going one way and you really think this case is going to be fought on appeal, then you want to make it appeal proof, as much appeal proof as you can. And so splitting the baby was not such a bad decision by the judge.
So when we're talking about this going to appellate court, one interesting wrinkle for me is that the Rams have already tried to go to appellate court a couple times. This trial hasn't even happened, and these guys are appealing to a higher authority. They have filed now two different writs of prohibition, going to appellate court, in one case saying that they need to move the case out of St. Louis. I think the other one had to do with some fines. I'm suddenly drawing a blank on this. But anyway, they're going to the appellate court and trying to get them involved. In both cases so far, the appellate court as well as the Missouri Supreme Court has said, no, we're going to let this one play out as it's going. Dave, do they risk annoying the appellate court? The fact they keep coming up, at some point, is this court going to say, hey, you guys are crying wolf. How can we even take this seriously?
No, I don't think that's a legitimate risk. I mean, part of the reason that judges are judges is because they are supposed to be able to kind of manage the annoyance that comes from this kind of situation. They're supposed to be able to look at each individual motion and argument on its own merits. And you may not even have the same judges reviewing these different writs that are getting sent up. You may have different panels that are reviewing them. So although, you know, a layperson might say, oh man, they're really going to be irritating these appellate courts, I don't think that's actually likely in the real world in this situation.
So someone with judicial temperament might approach this much differently than how I'm thinking of. That's a good reminder there. So Yinka made a good point about why the NFL, or Dave made a good point about the NFL maybe thinking that they're going to win this on appeal. There's a lot of people assuming that this case is going to settle as this continues to play out. Yinka, what's your best guess? Do you think this is going to trial?
Man. That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? You know, I would not be brave enough to wager a guess there. I mean, we've seen cases of this magnitude settle at the last minute, at the 11th hour, and then, you know, we've seen them go to trial. I think it seems to me that both parties are prepared for trial. I mean, January 10th is just right around the corner when you extract out the holidays. You know, I don't know. I do know, though, even before trial, there's a December 3rd show cause contempt hearing. And I think, you know, you talked about, is the appellate court going to be irritated? We know the trial court is irritated because, you know, the defendants have not produced the documents that have been required. Some of the documents have been required, except for Kroenke. He did. But the others have not. And so I think, you know, I think we'll know more. I think that December 3rd hearing will give us a signal potentially as to whether the NFL wants to take this all the way or whether they want to settle by New Year's or so.
Because these other NFL owners, they just don't want to turn over their financial records. That's what's going on with that hearing.
That's pretty much it.
Dave, your thoughts on this?
So one of the other ideas that's been tossed out there is that if the NFL doesn't want to settle, but they also don't want to go through with a trial, they could essentially strategically default here. So the penalty that's being discussed for the failure to comply with the court's orders is striking their pleadings, which means basically that the city would win a default judgment because the NFL's responses would then be removed from the record entirely. Now, there's a little bit of risk for the NFL there because essentially the judge has to decide what damages would be appropriate in light of this. But it's a way of the NFL preserving the privacy of the owner's information while at the same time not voluntarily entering into a settlement. Because right now I'm not sure what incentive St. Louis has to settle. St. Louis seems to have the NFL painted into a pretty tight corner And so it may be that strategic default is the cleanest way for the NFL to get out of its situation while still serving its ends of protecting the owner's privacy.
Wow. I mean, this is just so cinematic to me. Like, I love these various possibilities here. Nicole, your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a fascinating comment by Dave. Before he said that, I hadn't even thought of it. I was going to say, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it's going for trial. I mean, I listened to Sarah Swadesh on your show about a month ago. She was out for blood, and I thought, man, she represents the city of St. Louis perfectly, right?
Yeah. I mean, she made a great argument last month that the city
really
should
did
take this all the way.
That's right. And I thought this case is going to trial. Now, Dave makes a very interesting point there. I think we're all going to be, you know, on the edge of our seats.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have an interesting legal matter when even the lawyers are like riveted by it, Dave.
So one additional thing to add is even if the NFL has its pleading struck and a default is entered, the city would still have to prove damages, and the NFL gets to defend itself on the damages front. So that again is another reason why maybe they're not afraid of the idea of defaulting, because they would still then get to argue and put on evidence about damages.
But Dave, if they're arguing about damages, isn't that what the financial records are supposed to speak to? Wouldn't the owners still have to turn over their financial records just for the damage conversation?
Not necessarily, because the question in damages is what has the city suffered, not necessarily the financial position of the people who inflicted that suffering. So basically, St. Louis has to say, here are the ways that we have been impacted financially, and that doesn't necessarily relate to the financial standing of the NFL owners who made the decision in the first place. Do you see what I'm saying?
Even if that becomes, though, the punitive issue.
Right. I was going to disagree there. If there's a punitive damages issue, we do get to look into what they have and
that's
what is an appropriate amount for punishment purposes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's something they may be thinking. Even if we go this fascinating route that Dave has suggested, we'd still have to turn over those records anyway at
right.
some point.
Right.
Boy, what an interesting case. Well, we're going to keep an eye on this one. We need to take a quick break. I'm just so excited about the Rams. I can't even talk. When we come back, we're going to talk about Missouri's medical marijuana program. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. Choosewood.com.
Welcome back. We are talking to our legal roundtable. We have so many interesting matters on the table. We were just talking about the litigation surrounding the Rams. And now I've promised that we're going to talk about Missouri's medical marijuana program. So medical marijuana, Judge Nanette Lowry ruled against the state this past month. She granted a permanent injunction that was previously only temporary. And she said that the rules of the state's medical marijuana program, they barred companies with out-of-state owners from getting licenses to run things like dispensaries and other parts of this whole industry. She says those are unconstitutional. Now, we talked about this, I don't know, maybe about a year ago, and this was one that our panelists at the time saw coming. The state didn't seem to do anything in response to that. Nicole, what's the reasoning on this one?
So basically, it's a statute that discriminates, right? So it discriminates against out-of-state residents versus in-state residents, which if you're going to do that, then you have to, you have a heightened standard and you have to explain that there's some seriously justified reason. And there really isn't one. Really, it was discrimination for discrimination purposes. So, of course, it was the injunction was granted. So that's the problem here. There's no reason to discriminate against out-of-state residents for this purpose, or at least the state couldn't articulate one. And so that's what we have here.
So, Yinka, this seems to be a situation where this is pretty cut and dried. They couldn't do it the way that they did it. It seems hard to imagine now that this entire system of who got licenses and who didn't, I mean, this was a pretty big factor determining this. Is this just all being thrown out, like the proverbial bathwater? Like, the state's going to have to start from scratch on this?
There's a possibility. You have a lot of, as you've said, this is not the first case. There's already been a lot of litigation around this medical marijuana licensing. This is just one more. You know, when you look at what happened at trial, the trial was conducted virtually because of the pandemic. A lot of trials have been done that way. This was a bench trial. It took 8 minutes.
What? 8 minutes?
The ruling, you mean.
Eight minutes. Mm-hmm. The state basically took a knee. They offered no additional filing since their last one. So I think the state recognizes that they really don't have a leg to stand on. And yeah, there could be more litigation from folks who maybe applied in the past and were denied.
And we've already seen so much litigation, some of it successful, from Missouri companies that were kept out. It seems crazy because now you have some companies that have been operating for, I don't know, a year or so. And at the same time, you might have this whole system get chucked. It's hard to imagine that this is going to be a disaster for everybody except the lawyers. I don't see any way out of this. Anyway, we'll have updates on this as this continues. But I want to talk in the meantime. Missouri has a new oversight law for boarding schools and other residential care facilities. There have been some abuses at some of these throughout the state. That's generated a lot of headlines. State legislators wanted to crack down on this. And now one school, Heartland, has filed a lawsuit. They have residential recovery programs. They also have a boarding school. And they say this new law violates their First Amendment rights. Dave, before we get to the merits, what's kind of the gist of what they're saying here?
So when it comes to the First Amendment, what the boarding school is saying is that they have the right as a religious organization to decide who is going to act in a ministerial capacity for them, and that the government is not allowed to interfere with the decisions that they make about who gets to be a minister for their purposes. And they're relying in this situation on a case from a few years back called Hosanna Tabor, where the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously decided that you could not rely on civil rights laws to force a religious school to continue to employ a religious teacher who had violated their rules in some way. And the Supreme Court was very clear, look, you can't use the laws to interfere with that decision-making process as far as firing someone who has violated the religious group's rules. This situation, however, is different. It's not a question of requiring the religious group to continue employing someone. It's a question of whether they can employ them at all. And so basically what the boarding school is saying is some of the people that they would like to hire and employ in a ministerial capacity might not be able to pass background checks. Mm-hmm. Like they may have histories that the state would say makes them ineligible for working in this kind of capacity. And the boarding school says, hey, look, if we are comfortable with them, if we believe that they would be the best people to serve in this ministerial capacity, you don't get to tell us no. So it's kind of the flip side of the coin from this earlier case. And honestly, I don't know how this is going to turn out. Intuitively, as someone who believes very strongly in religious liberty, I like the idea of religious organizations being able to make their own decisions in this regard. But this may be a circumstance where the courts say, because you're dealing with minors who are arguably in a vulnerable situation, the government's interest in protecting those minors against potential criminal activity outweighs any interest that the religious organization has in having their chosen people in that ministerial capacity.
Interesting. Reading this thing, it felt like part of their argument was saying, we have the boarding school over here, and this is almost siloed from this recovery program that we have for adults. And if we want to hire these people who maybe have felony records because they've dealt with drug issues, and we want them to be able to work with this adult population, the state shouldn't be able to stop us from doing that just because there's a boarding school over here. Nicole, what do you make of that argument?
I don't like it at all. This is one of those cases that keeps me up at night. I did clergy abuse cases for, 8 years. This is a situation that makes me insane. Religious institutions should not be above state and government regulation. They just shouldn't, and especially when it comes to child abuse. So the state is trying to institute regulations that will be able to go and look at these religious schools for abuses, and it stemmed from that situation in rural Missouri where these this husband and wife were running this school that they claimed was a religious school. I don't know if that was legitimate or not. Mm-hmm. And they were abusing children at the school. And, you know, the state wasn't even allowed to go in and inspect that school because they claimed to be a religious school. So that's why we got this regulation. It went into effect in July, this July. And now we've got this challenge that this even bigger religious school now wants to say, hey, you can't come and regulate us because we're a religious school. Well, this is terrifying. Missouri is already one of only three states in the country that will not allow negligence against religious institutions for child abuse.
You say they won't allow negligence. You couldn't bring a negligence claim, you mean, as a lawyer?
Correct. You cannot bring a negligence claim. You can only bring intentional claims, which means every religious institution gets, how do I explain it, a free abuse until they already know someone's abusing, and then they bury their heads in the sand. That's how you prove intentional.
So they kind of have a pass on, oh, I didn't see it, so I'm not responsible.
Correct. So now this Hoshana Tabor case in the United States Supreme Court, I think what they're trying to do, what this school is trying to do, is broaden it to say, hey, you know, the fact that the United States Supreme Court has said you can't look into how we supervise our called employees, well, that means you can't regulate how we run our religious school either. So they're trying to seriously broaden the meaning of this Hoshana Tabor case. And if these schools persist in making this argument and win, then these schools can be potentially incredibly dangerous places.
Dave, I'd love to hear your thoughts on some of Nicole's points there.
Sure. So I think that from my libertarian perspective, one of the concerns that we have about regulations is that they sometimes prevent people from making free choices, even when there is no evidence that any wrong has actually been done. Okay, so by foreclosing a religious institution from hiring certain people, it means that even though there's no evidence that any of these people has done something in a particular circumstance to harm people associated with this religious organization, they're not allowed to make the free choice to take the risk of hiring someone with a certain type of criminal background. And from a religious perspective, that concerns me because religious groups tend to be focused on the idea of grace and redemption, the idea that mistakes that we've made, sins that we've committed in the past, don't necessarily define our destinies. And so I understand that there are risks involved when especially when you're talking about children and oversight of children. But one of the remarks that I would offer is, if there is probable cause to believe that any abuse is taking place, churches aren't exempt from investigations where there's probable cause. I don't think that regulations are absolutely necessary to police religious organizations and to stop church abuse. And in fact, sometimes the regulations go a good bit further than they really need to avoid the harm that's feared. And that would be my concern here.
Yeah, I love Dave Rowland's concept, if we lived in unicorn land, but we don't. And that's exactly how the priest abuse crisis has happened. And we've seen it happen. And it, you know, unfortunately, churches have not policed themselves, and they have not let's see, in putting forth this idea of grace and redemption, they've gone a little too far, and we've had children getting hurt. And I strongly believe when we're talking about children on the line who are often voiceless and can't come forward, that that's just not going to work.
So I'm going to just end this discussion on that point. I know Dave and Nicole just have some earnest philosophical differences on this, and I respect both of their perspectives, and how great to have two experts into this type of area here to join us. In our final couple minutes here, I want to get to one more item in the news. Faisal Khan, who's the health director of St. Louis County, flipped off some citizens after a contentious county council meeting this summer. He then wrote a letter claiming he'd been jostled by an angry mob and called racial slurs. Now, there has been no evidence to back up those claims. In fact, there seems to be some video that contradicts it. St. Louis County did an investigation, and they're saying they can't release the results. In fact, St. Louis County Executive Sam Page won't even turn the report over to the council to view behind closed doors. Page said the report involved a, quote, personnel matter, and therefore it was confidential. And the county has denied the Post-Dispatch open records request for the report. Yinky, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this one.
Yeah, this has been something of a high-profile issue in our region, and on one hand, you could understand the county executive's argument about personal records. However, if you have an open records request for I believe this was a public hearing, and so I think there's a difference there when it's a public hearing. So I think I'm not sure if that argument will ultimately be able to stand.
You're skeptical that this is going to stay behind closed doors.
Yes.
Dave, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I think one of the common misapprehensions is that just because the Sunshine Law allows certain records to be closed, it means that they are confidential, that they must be closed. And that's simply not true. Public governmental bodies do have the discretion to make open records relating to personnel issues. And given the high profile nature of this particular situation, and the fact that it happened in a public setting, in an open public meeting, I think that they should exercise their discretion to make this the results of the investigation available to the public. Certainly, I think it should be available to the council members. But again, can they be forced to do that? Maybe not.
Nicole, this could be an uphill battle in court, even if the county has every right to open this case, should they choose to.
Yeah, I mean, the Sunshine Law says that personnel records are closed, and I do think it complicates things that it was a public hearing. So I'm kind of splitting the baby here and not knowing exactly how this should go. But, you know, in terms of what they should do, that's a different issue. I think they should make it public, especially if they held it in a public hearing.
So it sounds like there's consensus with the team here. There's no reason they have to keep this closed. However, it sounds like everybody's saying this would be a hard one to win. Dave, would you bring a lawsuit to force them to open it if you had to rely on trying to win
I'd
that
bring
lawsuit?
The lawsuit.
Okay,
I just
bring the lawsuit.
I'd expect to win.
In our final 30 seconds here, do you think you could win that lawsuit?
Oh, man. I like to think that I could bring arguments that might win that lawsuit, but it would be tough.
It would be tough. Okay. And we're not going to see lawyers who aren't working for public interest law firms taking this one on. There's maybe not
right.
the biggest chance of making a payday on this one.
Right.
Well, all right. Sounds like that might be the end of this matter, even if philosophically the county has no reason they should keep this one closed. Well, we have had such a good time with our legal roundtable today. It's been such a joy to have these guys here and digging into the law with us. Dave Rowland, litigation director at the Freedom Center of Missouri, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's always a great time, Sarah.
And Nicole Gorofsky, former prosecutor, now in practice at Gorofsky Law, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Yinka Folati, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
And Yinka is also a former prosecutor. He's a former litigator at Bryan Cave Leighton Paisner and the 2020 Democratic nominee for Missouri Secretary of State.
This episode was produced by Sarah Fenske with audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr. Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here. find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air, suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations, and leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. ChooseWood.com.